Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Henry Cowan, and he'll be answering your most important questions on sodium-free stripers. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're going to be broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Henry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Henry Cowan about sodium-free stripers. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I've ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kickboats, I'm convinced that Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at, as Dave Whitlock put it, the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's www.bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Henry, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And for our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in the drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Henry's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $25 gift certificate for Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, which you can redeem in their shop or online. And here's how you can win that $25 gift certificate. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be something that Henry and I talk about during the show. So you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. It's the same text box that you use to ask questions during the show. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and you may win that $25 gift certificate. Our guest tonight is Henry Cowan, and Henry has been pursuing striped bass for over 30 years in both saltwater and freshwater. He's currently guiding in freshwater on Lake Sidney Lanier north of Atlanta, Lake Allatoona in northwest of Atlanta, and Chattahoochee River in Atlanta. He guides for landlocked stripers, hybrids, spotted bass, and carp. He fishes both fresh and saltwater game fish approximately 200 days a year. Henry is an accomplished fly designer, as his trademark fly patterns are sold nationally through Umpqua Feather Merchants. As an Umpqua royalty fly designer, his patterns appear and are available in Orvis catalog, as well as Cabela's, L.L. Bean, Bass Pro Shops, and all fly shops across the United States that carry Umpqua flies. His fly patterns, as well as his articles on how to tie them, appeared in magazines such as American Angler, Fly Fishing in Saltwaters, Angler Magazine, Fly Fish America, Fly Tire, Fly Fisherman, Saltwater Fly Fishing, and many more. Currently, Henry's name appears on the masthead of American Angler Magazine as a contributing writer and editor. Henry has appeared as a guest on a number of national televised outdoor shows, including The Outfitters, The Orvis Sporting Life, The Real Guys, One More Cast with Shaw Grisby, The Nuts and Bolts of Fishing, Travis Johnson Outdoors, and O'Neill Outside, as well as some regional outdoor television shows. Henry, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Good evening, Roger. Thanks for having me on.
Well, good to have you, and nice. Actually feel like summer's starting out here in Colorado, so off to a good season, June 1st. Yeah,
are the mayflies hatching?
I don't know. I haven't been down there today.
I imagine you're awfully close.
Yeah. I'm close to the North Fork of the South Platte River and close to a nice little private lake just down the hill here. So it's always nice and close. Well, good. Well, we got lots of questions tonight. We're talking about stripers. We haven't talked about stripers in a long time on the show, so this is be good to revisit these incredible fish. So let's start at the beginning and just talk about, you know, what are freshwater stripers? You know, how we always think of stripers generally as saltwater fish. How do we get them over into the freshwater and how do they learn to adapt?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It started many, many years ago. You know, most, as you said, most people thought of stripers being, you think of the East Coast, you know, basically from Maine all the way down through North Carolina and into the South Carolinas. And we actually have some fish down on the Florida coast. And as you know, you also have fish out on the California Delta on the West Coast. So we think of these fish mostly as saltwater fish. But back in the 1950s, it all happened when a lake known as Santee Cooper, or Lake Moultrie, ended up getting dammed. And these fish would run from the coast up the river systems into the lake. And when they dammed the lake up, they found that stripers were actually thriving and surviving that got caught behind the dam. And so that's how we learned that stripers can live both in salt water and freshwater. And since that day, back in the 50s, when that all happened, since then, a lot of our states across the United States have started implanting striped bass, mostly to control threadfin shad populations. And that's how they started getting put into these freshwater impoundments throughout the country. And they're in, I don't know exactly how many states, but I would venture to guess that we probably have striped bass and, in some cases, hybrids. Probably in at least 35, maybe 38 states across the United States. So there's a vast range of where they can live. And so that's kind of how they got in there, was they were actually implanted mostly by, Department of Natural Resources of the different states.
But by chance, the first time around, basically.
The first time around, they got blocked in. Somebody closed the gate, and they couldn't get out, and that's how they found out that they can actually survive quite well in both salt or fresh water. They can live nicely in either one.
Now, do saltwater stripers, were they running up the river to spawn? Was that their...
Yeah, most of the time they would run up the rivers to spawn, and that's how they get into these lakes, and the spawning runs usually occur in the late spring. March, April, May, that's when it happened originally back in South Carolina at Santee Cooper.
Okay. And nowadays, are they bringing freshwater stripers then to other impoundments and so forth to get them started? Or are they...
No question. And you know, there are, once they get them started, depending on the system, where they're living, some of the stripers can actually breed and repopulate themselves, where there are others that absolutely can't. It all depends on the length of the river. In order for a striped bass to be able to spawn successfully, their eggs have to tumble normally in a river system. It doesn't have to be in a river. There are some areas where there are lakes where they somehow can reproduce in a lake, but for the most part, the fish will run upriver, drop their eggs, and the eggs need to tumble between like 48 and 72 hours. And so if your river system's long enough, you know, the males and the females go upriver, spawn, do their thing, and the eggs tumble, and they hatch, you know, 72 hours later into little fry. But like on my river system that I'm fishing, which is Lake Lanier has two rivers that feed our lake, the Chattahoochee and the Chestatee, our river systems aren't long enough. So what happens is we get a spawning run, just like most of the other rivers would, but what happens is the eggs tumble for, say, 24 to 48 hours and then end up you know, hitting the lake. There's not enough river system to keep them tumbling. They end up falling to the bottom of the lake, get silted over, and just never come to be fry. So for lakes like Lake Lanier, where I fish out of, or Lake Allatoona, the Department of Natural Resources, the Georgia Department of Natural Resources, actually has stocking programs, and they have hatcheries just like they would for trout. And they actually take stripers and raise them in the hatcheries, and when they become about 1 inch long in size, they go around in the spring, in the late spring, and they put them in various lakes. And to date, in the state of Georgia where I live, we probably produce somewhere in the neighborhood of between 2.5 and 3 million fingerling striped bass a year.
Wow. And how long do they live?
You know, they can live up to about 14 years. That's about as long as a striper can live. Our state record, our lake record on Lanier is about 47 and 3/4 pounds. There are obviously plenty of 50, 55-pound stripers. I could tell you some of the great areas where you can catch some big striped basses in the state of Kentucky and Tennessee has just some absolutely kick-butt striped bass fishing where you can get some really big fish. And I know they have them in California as well. But I would say that from a size standpoint, Kentucky and Tennessee are probably two of the most well-known or noted states in the country where they just have monster striped bass being caught. On Lanier, our average fish is probably somewhere between 8 and 12 pounds on average, which is interesting because for most saltwater guys, you know, up and down the East Coast, the average fish is probably in the 3 to 5-pound class. Or if you look at the guys out in the California Delta, their average fish is probably anywhere from 1 to 3 pounds on average. And not that they don't catch 5, 7, 10, 15, 20-pound fish, but just on average, that's their average size. They're smaller. Our lakes in the southeast generally have a larger size range for the impounded fish versus the free-range fish in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. So there are actually wild freshwater stripers in some fisheries, then.
Yeah, I guess we would call them wild. Yeah, they're definitely reproducing. There's no question about it.
That's cool.
You know, there's no question about it.
Now, there are, we talk about striped bass, but there's also a hybrid as well. Well, first of all, is there only one species of striped bass in the freshwater system?
You know, there isn't real. Yeah, that, you know, it's funny that I get asked that question. There's, what they basically do is where the Department of Natural Resources will pull their fish from certain strains. Ours mostly, originally, I believe, came from the Savannah River, you know, basin here in Georgia. And so those are the stripers that we used for our breeding stocks. But, you know, for lakes that are further south than Lanier, Lanier is a north, you know, is north of Atlanta. It's what we would call a mountain lake. It's a deep, clear, cold lake. But we have some lakes that are not quite as deep that are further south, and those fish can't take the heat as, you know, up the ones up north can't take the heat as well as the ones down south. And the reason being is that the ones down south, their water temperature on those lakes is so much warmer, they use a more southern strain of striped bass to put in the lake that may come out of, say, Florida. And they can breed with use those fish, the Gulf stripers out of Florida, and there are some fish there that they can use that can actually tolerate the warmer waters, and those fish will be planted in a warmer reservoir, say, than some of the mountain lakes that we have up north. So there are a couple of different strains of fish that can come out of different areas, but for the most part, they all look the same pretty much. You know what I mean? A striper is a striper is a striper. You know, some of them have beautiful straight lines going across. Some of them have a little bit of a broken line, and sometimes, you know, we talk about hybrids, and they always have that broken lateral line, and it's sometimes it's hard to tell because not every striper has a straight across beautiful line. Some of them actually are crooked as well and have that variegated kind of a broken lateral line, and so it's, sometimes it can be hard to tell. But for the most part, they're all, you know, they're all Maroon saxatilis, you know.
Mm-hmm. Phil in Kentucky asked about do you target hybrid striped bass as well as striped bass in fresh water. He says, I believe that hybrids are available in more locations than our striped bass. Is that true?
Yeah, I think there's probably I think there's probably more Department of Natural Resources across the country breeding and raising in their pens hybrids than there are stripers. I don't know if it's just a little more difficult to raise stripers and in captivity, and it might be a lot easier to raise the to crossbreed the hybrid, which basically is a striped bass mixed with a white bass. So that's what they're doing. So I do target both. My lake Altoona that I fish in the summertime is a striped bass and a hybrid bass lake. They have both species. Lake Lanier, where I do most of my fishing, is striped bass only. Just about every lake in the state of Georgia has stripers and hybrids in it. Lanier, the one that I fish most of my season, is 100% a striper lake. They will not put, Department of Natural Resources will not put hybrids in that lake, as they want to deem it a trophy striped bass lake. And so, obviously, the stripers grow a lot bigger than the hybrids do. But they're different fish, and they act differently. And so, but I would think there are, looking across the country, I think there are hybrids probably in more locations than there are striped bass. I would agree with Phil.
Okay. Another second part of Phil's question was basically, do you fish for them differently, hybrids versus striped bass, or do you use basically the same techniques?
No, the techniques are similar. I'm fishing them different times a year. There's basically two ways that we fish for both stripers and hybrids. You're either catching them on the surface or you're going subsurface. And it's obviously a whole lot easier to catch a fish when he's on the surface than it is when you're trying to locate fish when you don't see anything, out and it looks like just a barren lake. And now you got to find where these fish are hiding or cruising. And, we like to think that what separates the men from the boys is when you can catch them just as easy subsurface as you can on the surface. So we do fish them, though, very similarly. It's just that they're doing different things and targeting different parts of the lake at different times a year just because of how they can handle water temperature. Hybrids can handle warmer water a lot more easily than a striped bass can. A striped bass, once they get it that 8-10 pound range or bigger, they just don't handle warm water quite as well as a hybrid will. So I think consequentially that's one of the reasons why many of the impoundments across the country tend to put in hybrids, is because they're just more easy to manage that warm water in the heat of the summer. That's when our striped bass become susceptible to mortality in a lot of the lakes around the country is the summertime.
So do you think seasonally for striped bass, is your prime fishing season fall, winter, spring?
Yeah, okay. I say 100%. Here's the thing, Roger. So I start my season on Lanier, and everything that we're going to talk about tonight for me is based on, my guiding in Lake Lanier. But, I want our listeners out there to know, striped bass don't know where they live. So when I'm relating something to Lanier, you can relate it to, a lake in California, a lake in Virginia, a lake in Kentucky, a lake in Pennsylvania. It doesn't matter. What you need to know is that everything is based on water temperature. That's the most important thing in looking and hunting for striped bass. So for me, I start my fishing around early to mid-October. And I will go straight through until around June 1. And not that I can't catch them in June, I certainly can, but by the time June comes around, there's other things to catch down here in Atlanta that are just as much fun. So I kind of start laying off the stripers in June. And quite frankly, by July and then especially into August and September, I won't go anywhere near the lake for stripers, even though they are holed up in big groups 30 feet down. And you can find big schools of them, and they're just really easy pickings. That's really the time when the worst mortality is going to occur, so I just completely lay off those fish.
Yeah, and that was a question by Tom in Roswell, Georgia. He says, do you think striped bass fishing should be restricted during summer months due to mortality from heat-related stress on the fish? And he also says, are the conditions present in Lanier that resulted in fish kills in Lake Hartwell? So, you know, I guess he's asking, you know, do you have the possibility of fish kills in Lake Lanier due to...
We do. We do. You know, I don't want to answer too many questions from Tom T. because I know he fishes my lake. And so I don't want to give out too many of my secrets to Tom T. So just so you know. No, I'm kidding. But the truth is, yeah, we can get fish kills. It's all about water quality. That's what the difference between why one lake seems to fish better than another lake for striped bass most of the time is based on water quality.
And then about the hybrids, what would be the season for the hybrids?
Well, you could fish the hybrids 12 months a year because they can actually tolerate the that warmer water temperature. So, you know, when I fish Lake Alatoona, many a time those hybrids are actually busting the surface. July, August, September could be really good times a year to look for schooling fish. So, you know, it's just a matter of what do you want to do. You know, the key to striper and hybrid fishing, if we were to lump them together, is to learn the patterns. The pattern is going to change throughout the season. You know, I don't want to relate it strictly to trout fishing, but if we were to look at trout fishing, how we fish for trout in November, December, and January is a whole lot different than how we would fish for trout or look for trout in, you know, May, June, and July, just from what bugs are hatching, whether they're eating on the surface versus nymphs below the surface, and, you know, if there's a lot of bugs hatching or they're just laying on the bottom, you know, because the water's cold and they're just a little more lethargic. And striper fishing is kind of, and hybrid fishing is kind of the same thing. It's a matter of learning the patterns. You know, all these things care about is, where's my next meal coming from? Where's the bait? You find the bait, you find the fish. So where the bait is going to be determined on what the water temperature is, because whatever the water temperature is tells you what the bait in your lake will be doing. And that goes for almost any species, whether even if we're talking largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, pickerel, anything else. You know, the fish are doing basically where they can find their next meal. And most lakes have channels in it. And I'm not talking about small lake. I'm talking about big, expansive lakes. They have channels in it, and these fish will ride the channels and then get off, like highways, get off the highways to go and feed and look for that Shoney's or Waffle House, if you will, get out and feed, and they get back in the channel and continue to swim until they figure out where their next meal is going to be. And that's the key, is really trying to find out what the fish are doing at a certain time of the year, and it all goes back to water temperature.
Okay. One other question from Fred in New Jersey, and this may be a tough one to answer, but he asked, you know, biologically, what changes with these fish when they're exposed to both fresh and salt versus just fresh? And you fish both salt and fresh. One thing that comes to my mind is the strength of the fish. Are the salt ones that go from fresh to salt stronger?
You know, I don't know that they're any stronger. I'll tell you this. They can live in both. It doesn't make a difference. The striped bass can live in both fresh and salt. We've learned that they're genetically able to do that. It's the physiology of the fish, apparently, that allows them to do well in both. So a striper doesn't care whether it's in fresh or in salt. If it's in salt, then it, you know, it keeps more fresh water inside its body, and if it's in fresh, it keeps more salt water, the salt inside its body, to get that correct balance. But what's interesting is that freshwater stripers are of two kinds. We have what we call the warm water, those that are in lakes and impoundments, and then there are those that live in rivers the whole year. The striped bass in the river systems fight every bit as hard as the stripers in salt water, because a river is like having current, like which
right.
We have tide and salt. The ones in fresh water, because they don't have that kind of current, they still fight really, really hard, but probably not quite as hard.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know that there's a number we could put on it, but let's put it this way. A 10-12 pound striped bass in salt water can take you into its backing pretty quickly. In a river, easily into its backing. On the lake, it might or it might not take you into backing. It just depends on,
mm-hmm.
you know, the size of the fight and the fish versus, you know, the fish and the fight kind of thing.
Okay, and one final question before we take a break is, are the freshwater stripers facing any other threats to their general health other than the heat aspect of things?
Well, the heat aspect, the heat really, you know, it's all about dissolved oxygen and having good water quality for them to survive in the summer. Pressure, obviously, you know, can mean a lot to the striped bass. Whether a lake gets, you know, heavily overfished can do a lot to the mortality. The interesting thing, when guys fish for stripers in the summertime, you know, we've heard, and there's no real hard, accurate data that we can get out of it, but from years of listening to what these biologists have written, one of our old lake biologists has said that upwards of a minimum of 75% of those fish caught and released in the summertime will not live. So one of the other things that they deal with is in these freshwater impoundments over the summer, because of the heat, is starvation. A lot of the bait that the striped bass like to eat, which in most lakes across the country is threadfin shad. That's one of two or three baits that you'll find, forage fish that you'll find in almost all lakes. Threadfin shad is probably the biggest. Threadfin shad can tolerate warm water a lot better than stripers can. So in the summer, the stripers go deep, and the threadfin shad can stay up high in the water column. Consequently, the striped bass are not getting nourished nearly as well as they need to in the summertime. So it's good if it has another forage fish that it can feed on and stay healthy through the summer months. So that's another thing, you know, malnutrition can really hurt these fish, but it all goes back to water quality and temperature.
Right. Okay, good. Let's, Henry, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about freshwater stripers some more. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the country. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Henry Cowan about sodium-free stripers. If you'd like to ask Henry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to ask your question. We'll try to answer as many of those questions on the show tonight as we can. So, Henry, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world. Tell us a little bit about your business down there and any other, you know, things going on that you're doing with fly fishing.
Well, you know, we run a guide business down here. We're just north of Atlanta, probably maybe 30 to 40 minutes just north out of Atlanta. And so this time of year, believe it or not, I'm kind of just – my striper trips have just wound down at this point, Roger, so – I am on to one of my favorite species now. I am carp fishing down here for the next couple of months. We have in town, in literally 15, 20 minutes north of Atlanta, we have some flats on the Chattahoochee River that basically what we're doing is just taking people out and poling them around in literally 4 to 12 inches of water and sight fishing to carp in some areas that you'd think you were in the Everglades, and you're literally 20 minutes outside of the city of Atlanta, or, you know, with 6 million people. It's just fantastic. So we just started our carp season last week, and so that's kind of what we're doing next. And then I've got some buddies that are full-time bait fishing guides. You know, Roger, for me, I'm very fortunate. Being one of the only fly fishing guides on the lakes down here, most of the guides, and these are big lakes, you know, Lanier is a 38,000-acre, 600-plus-mile shoreline lake. Altoona is another giant lake down here. Most of the guys down here are bait guides, and so they're fishing with live baits for most of their clients. They don't look at me as a threat, so I get some really great information because of that. So as soon as that hybrid topwater bite starts, that'll be the next thing that we work on. So if anybody's interested, they can go to our website at www.henrycowanflyfishing.com, and they can take a look at. We've got some really good photos and videos and stuff of what our fishery is like, and you know, we get calls all the time from people that come down and they don't want to fly fish. They want to, you know, fish with conventional gear, which I'm happy to do. Some of my customers are fly. Some of them are conventional. I just don't do the bait and the trolling thing, but we'll hook them up with the right people if that's what they want to do. You know, it's not about me and my business. It's about getting the people to the right guide when they do come to Atlanta, whether it's on pleasure or business or whatnot. So not a long drive out of the city if you're flying in on business to come and experience what goes on here. The nice thing about our fishery, Roger, is that the cool part about it, in short, is that where most people's fisheries shut down in November and fire back up in April, our fishing is just getting started. You know, November, December, January, February, March, right. April, great trout. You know, great striper fishing, really good bass fishing. So that we're kind of blessed in the South to have just something to do without having to leave the country to get into some good fishing in the winter.
Yeah, sounds like a great place. Yeah, you get those long layovers in Atlanta. It's a good
thing. Yeah, you know, well,
you're not too far away.
You're not too far away. Yeah, that's true. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump. So.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing that with us and. Everybody, again, Henry Cowen, and that's cowen.com. So check Henry's site out, and if you're down there on a business trip, whatever, look him up. I'm sure he'll enjoy taking you out. Well, good. Let's back to the questions. We've got some equipment questions that came in. Jason in Ashland, Kentucky, asked about size rod and reel. Weight of line. What kind of rig do you use?
You know, a striped bass rig will be your typical redfish or bonefish kind of an outfit. You know, I like an 8 or a 9 weight outfit. 9 foot long is fine. That doesn't mean you can't use some of the shorter 8 foot long rods. They're fine as well. But generally speaking, on my boat, if you were to come and say, you know, what are you using? I've got, 9 foot long, 8 weights and 9 weights. And, you know, any rod will do, quite frankly. Any brand is fine as long as it's TFO. I'm kidding. I was just trying to get a laugh out of you, Roger.
You got one.
Well, good. No, we like a lot of the brands. But anyway, and as far as reels, just a reel that can hold 150 to 200 yards of backing, it's obviously good to have a good drag on it so that because these fish are going to take you and put you on the reel most of the time. If there's not a lot of hand stripping in, very rarely do we see fish under 4 or 5 pounds on my lake. So we don't catch a lot of those smaller fish. They're mostly in that, you know, small fish for us is 4 pounds, and then it gets on up. So most of the fish are going to get on the reel. So you need something with a fairly good drag system. As far as lines go, you know, to me it's all about the line, Roger. I am big. Rods are fine. You know, you like spending $800-$900 on a rod, God bless you. It's a great piece of equipment. I'm okay with a $200 rod. It's all about the line we use. And so the key to striper fishing is going to be to make sure you have lines that can hit all depths of the water column. A floating line when the fish are eating on the surface and you want to throw a popper or a slider-type fly. An intermediate line is one of my favorites, especially in the winter when the fish are feeding just under the surface, or even sometimes they're on the surface, but, you know, the bigger schools of fish are just subsurface, and that intermediate, that slow sinking line is just a great tool to have. And, you know, I'm a big, I don't know if I'm supposed to mention this, but I'm a big Rio guy. I just love what the guys at Rio do. And so I consequentially use a lot of their outbound short lines, especially their floating intermediate line, the FI, which is about a 20, 30-foot head of intermediate on the front, followed by a floating line on the back. And what I really like about that line is if I have a customer making a cast, you know, let's say off the bow of the boat, let's say 10 o'clock on an angle because there's some fish up, and by the time he gets the cast out, those fish have now gone straight in front of the boat. You can take that floating intermediate line and lift it right back up and correct that cast immediately. With where a full intermediate line, you're going to have to strip that line in before you're going to be able to get that line out. So I really like the FI lines that those guys at Rio are offering. And then my staple is a sinking line, a fast sinking line, like a Type 6 or a 350 grain line. And a lot of the fly companies are all, you know, Cyangler and Rio, and they're all making nice sinking lines today. But the 350 grain line, for a 9-weight or a 300-grain line or anything in a type 6 that's a fast-sinking line, something that sinks about 6 inches per second, is enough to get you down to fish that we can fish to at 25, 30 feet successfully. So that's kind of where I am on the equipment, on the equipment stuff.
Bob in Maryland asked, he says, is it worth buying a striper specialty line? And he mentions Rio's In Touch. Or can I make do with the fly lines I have?
You can make do with anything you want. It's just a matter of, you know, how effective you want to be, how far you want to cast. You know, I like the In Touch fly lines just because they have that low stretch, so you can feel just the little tick of a resistance of a fish. You know, a striper, sometimes it'll be a hard pull, especially in the spring and in the fall. But in the winter, when they get a little more lethargic and they're on that itty-bitty little threadfin shad, they're on those tiny baits that are between a half inch and 2 inches long, sometimes I think it's an advantage to have those in-touch lines, those lines with low stretch, and you can just feel the little bit of a prick that you're going to feel and come back and set on that fish. So I actually like those specialty lines.
So those, so they're not, basically what I hear you saying is these small bait fish, they're just not hitting them that hard because they don't need to hit them that hard.
They don't need to. They just go, you know, you'll see them, you'll actually see them, and in the wintertime, we see them on top, but sometimes you just go out for whatever reason, they're not on top. You'll see big groups of fish and bait 15, 20, 25 feet down, and they're just, but when you see them near the surface, it's really interesting to watch these fish. You'll come out and you'll see literally a school of bait just under the surface. And these stripers will be, you'll see little what we call toilet flushes, you know, the fish kicking up water and blowing water. And a lot of guys will come with conventional rods and start throwing poppers and stuff at these fish that they're seeing blowing bait on top of the water. But the fish really aren't eating on top of the water. They're eating a foot or two under the surface. And if you watch these fish, you'll actually see them coming up from deep, rolling on their sides, opening their mouth, gliding, and just taking in just gobs of these little 1.5-inch long shad, giving a kick with their tail and going back down 20 feet deep. And so what you're seeing is that prop wash when they give a kick from their tail. And but they're not, it's not a vicious strike like you would expect to get when you're, say, for a saltwater guy who fishes, you know, a menhaden or a bunker or,
right,
or a big herring. It's not that vicious strike, or if you fish conventional gear and ever fish like a Zara spook, and you're watching come the fish just, you know, it looks like somebody dropped a cinder block from a two-story building and it made a big splash in the water. When they're eating little bitty baits, it's much more subtle. It's more of a finesse game. So that's when I think those specialty lines really can make a difference.
Okay, and a question from somebody that likes the Red Sox. I didn't leave his name.
We're not going to listen. Even though I'm in Georgia, Roger, I'm a Yankees guy. So
yeah.
I'm not going to answer any questions from Red Sox fans.
From Red Sox fans. Okay, too bad. Anyways, it's Ty Henry. Can you please discuss your thoughts on tapered leaders versus straight line? Also, what is the heaviest pound test you use, and what is the lightest? He says, I have a tough time turning over flies like your coyote over with anything lighter than 16 to 20-pound test.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm surprised it came from a Red Sox fan. you know, tapered leaders to me are very important when we're throwing intermediate lines and we want to turn that fly over and we want that fly to be near the surface. So that's when a tapered leader is very important to me. I use a straight piece when I'm using a fast sinking line. I don't care how my fly lands on the surface. If the fish are 15 feet down, I need to get my line down. All right. So when I'm using a fast sinking line like a type 6 or a 300, I might just use 5 foot of 15 or 20 pound test, tie my fly to it, and I'm done. A shorter leader will get that fly down quickly than a longer leader will. The tapered leader is certainly better when you're trying to turn a fly over. And for a coyote, yeah, 15-pound test is about right. I can turn it over with 12, but 15-pound test is probably about right. For, believe it or not, when I'm popper fishing on the surface, I don't use a long leader. I could just take a straight piece of 20 or 25 or even 30 for that matter And I could, you know, that fly will turn over just beautifully with the popper. It's not a problem. So I'll use a shorter piece of leader when I'm popper fishing on top at times as well. It takes that wind resistance. It just makes it a little bit easier to get that fly out there. But overall, I am generally in that 15 to 20 pound range, that 15 to 20 pound test leader range. That's my tippet. I will go down to 12 at times if they're super finicky, like in the wintertime if they're eating that itty-bitty bait, and if I'm not getting the bites, I will definitely go down to 12-pound test. It's not had to happen very often. It's generally not a cause-effect of the leader as it probably is your fly that you're using if you're not getting the eats from a striped bass in the wintertime. It's generally because you're not matching the hatch rather than, you know, having a too heavy leader. I can take my little something else fly that I use, and I can put that on 20-pound tippet and with a straight piece of 5 foot of 20-pound tippet and just throw that out there, and I'll have no problem getting an eat. So it's not so much the size of the leader that's going to prevent fish from feeding. Obviously, the size of the leader will, if it's not correctly put together, it can hinder turning that fly over. There's no question about it. And if you're using a bigger fly, you're obviously going to want to have more of a, you know, more tapered leader in the heavier weight range if it's a bigger, more wind-resistant fly.
The Red Sox fan also asked about whether fluorocarbon is that important on Lake Lanier.
You know, I don't know the answer to that one. I can just tell you that fluorocarbon to me is like fishing with confidence. You have that favorite fly or that favorite lure that you go out with, and you just feel confident that you're going to get an eat if the fish are in the mood to eat that day, that you know they're not going to miss it. I mean, you know, you take a clouser minnow, tied in olive with a smidgen of hot pink over white, and to me that's one of the most effective colors that I can fish anywhere for striped bass. Freshwater, saltwater, makes no difference to me. Olive, hot pink, and white is a great combination, and so I like having a fluorocarbon leader. The only time I don't fish a fluorocarbon leader is when I'm surface fishing, because fluorocarbon sinks and I want to keep my fly up a little higher on the water. So I will use just regular monofilament when I'm popper fishing, and other than that, I usually put on fluorocarbon, and so I feel confident with it. Now, if you ask my good buddy Lefty Cray about that, he'd giggle and say, it doesn't make a difference, and he's probably right.
Yeah. Like you say, confidence. It helps sell product, too.
Yeah, no, I do, though. I do sometimes think, listen, I can't tell you how many times I've trout fished, and if I didn't have I'm not much of a nymph fisherman, but, boy, when I put on a fluorocarbon, you know, leader with a nymph, it seems like I'm getting more bites than I am if I'm fishing just a straight piece of mono kind of monofilament leader. So I think there's something to it.
Yeah.
I don't know what the Tenkara guys would say about that, but are they fly fishing?
Are they fly fishing?
I'm kidding.
Yeah, Daniel's not gonna. He's not gonna like you talking that way.
I'm just throwing him some. You know what?
Yeah. Hey, there was an article in one of the magazines this month. It was a tarpon on Tenkara.
I love that. I think that's outrageous. I just think that's outrageous.
Yeah, it was a good title on the cover. Made me go look.
Tenkara tarpon. Unbelievable.
Yeah. One other question, then we'll take a quick break. Is there any other equipment you have in the boat that you think is a necessity?
Yeah, I do. I think an electric trolling motor is a necessity. Without an electric trolling motor, you're out of the game.
Okay.
A pair of binoculars is a must when you're striper fishing, because you just always can't see certain things, whether it's fish on the surface or wildlife, certain birds that are tipping me off as to where the bait is. So I think two of the most important things, absolutely an electric trolling motor and a pair of binoculars is a must for all boaters when you're striper fishing. I think those are the two biggies.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll come right back and talk more about stripers. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips, fin fishing trips for warm water species. please visit their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Henry Cowan about sodium-free stripers. If you'd like to ask Henry a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of the questions you send in as possible tonight on the show. Let me just grab a drink of water here. Okay. Now, let me look at a couple of these questions that have come in online, Henry. And I know one of them backtracks a little bit. Phil in Kentucky asks, when does the topwater bite for hybrid stripers that you mentioned get going?
Well, you know, the topwater bite from us, we get a quick topwater bite for the stripers in the end of September, really middle of October is kind of when you start looking the end of September if the water cools down, but if not, it's going to be middle end of October. You know, when that water temp drops down to about 75 degrees, ideal topwater bites is going to be between 70 and 75 degrees. So depending on where your lake is located and what kind of a season you're having, that usually occurs for us in October until around first week of November. So we get about a three-week period of a topwater bite, and then we get it again in May. We get a topwater bite in May when that water temp once again is rising up from 70 to 75 degrees. So that 70, 75-degree water temperature mark is going to be your key indicator as to when to look for stripers on the surface. And, you know, it could stretch up to 77, 78, could start maybe even at 68, 69, but that's that 5-degree range where you're really going to start seeing them hitting the surface. Now, we have plenty of fish that you'll see surface, you'll see the surface feed, the blitzing as we call it, in November, December when the water temp is, you know, 60, 55, 50 degrees, but I don't really consider that topwater. Even though we're seeing the fish blowing up on the surface, it's not a topwater bite. You will never get those fish to eat something off the surface. Those fish are eating 1 to 3 feet below the surface. So it's really important to know, if you're talking topwater, are you wanting to fish for them on topwater? Because I see many fish on top, you know, blowing up bait just under the surface, but as I spoke about before, as they're rushing up to the surface, and they're grabbing that bait, and then they turn and go down, you'll see a kick with the tail, and guys are going, oh, look, they're feeding on the top, but they're really not. It's really a faux topwater bite. Those fish are feeding between 1 to 5 feet below the surface, and you're just way better off during certain times of the year catching those fish on a slow-sinking intermediate than you would be with a floating line trying to throw a pop or a banger or a pole dancer or whatever it is you're going to throw on top, a gurgler. So look for that water temp to be your indicator of 70 to 75 degrees.
For top water.
For top water stripers. Now, hybrids can take it a lot warmer than that. Hybrid top water bite, water temp could be anywhere between 70 and 82, 83. I mean, they can really get up on the surface and feed during some extreme heat. So most of your top water bites for your hybrids are going to occur June, July, August, September, when that water temp is, generally speaking, I would say for hybrids, it's a 75 to 85 degree range. So they can take that warmer water temperature a lot better than the stripers can.
Phil also asked another question online here about water temperature. He says, what depth limits are you dealing with when you fish your flies for stripers, and what water temperatures do stripers seek?
You know, they're happy when that water temp anywhere between, say, 47 and 75, they're happy fish. And I know that's a very broad range.
Yeah.
And it is. But they're happy in that range. Once it gets above 75, they become a little less happy. And once that water temp drops below 48, 47, they become a little less happy. But the question is, so I fish any time in between that range is great. The question is, what is the bait doing during that time? So, you know, on my lakes, in the wintertime, when that water temp is dropping to 50, 49, 48, 47, it's getting cold. The threadfin shad are not happy. They're really uncomfortable in cold water. So they tend to go into the backs of the coves and get on the red clay banks in the wintertime. And the reason they do that is because that afternoon sun in the winter here in Georgia can heat the backs of those coves up maybe 1-1.5 degrees. And that 1-1.5 degree water change in the back of the cove makes them happy. So the stripers are just looking, where's the bait? Where's the forage? So in the winter, we look in the backs of the coves. So really the question is, when we're targeting fish, we're really trying to figure out, what is the bait doing? What is the forage fish doing so that we can target those fish during the different times of the year? But so that's really the whole key to striper fishing. We actually, the way a saltwater guy uses a tide chart to figure out where the fish are going to feed during certain parts of a tide, you know, there may be a channel that becomes, that underwater has an oyster bar on it or a clam bar, and that clam bar at low tide has no water, but when that tide starts coming up, those fish line up waiting to see what's going to come up into that channel. So you're using different periods of the tide to tell you where the fish should be at certain times of the year. And we don't have the tides on the freshwater scene. So we just need to kind of know, what's the bait doing based on the water temperature? Is it going to be in the channels? Is it going to be up high? Is it going to be in the backs of the coves? Is it going to be up on the points? You know, are they, when they're spawning, is that, you know, this, when redfin shad and herring and whatnot spawn in the springtime, they need, their eggs need to attach to something hard. So they come up to places like boat marinas and breakwaters and rocks, and that's the time of year where we use structure to find the fish, is during the forage spawn, because they need to be able to kick their tails and have their eggs to adhere to something. So it's all a matter of what, it's so water temperature related, and just learning those patterns of where the bait's going to be at certain water temperatures is going to give you a big advantage to just going out on the lake and just saying, well, I think I'm going to go to the north end of the lake today, or I think I'm going to go to south end of the lake, or let's fish this cove or whatnot. So, you know, trying to find the bait is really the key. And water temperature is one big thing that helps, and then wildlife is the other thing. You know, what are the birds doing? There's so much great information you can get from what the wildlife is doing, whether it's terns and gulls or loons or greater blue herons that we have all over our lakes. Those are the best fishermen on the lakes right there, that wildlife. And trying to find that wildlife and see what they're doing can tell you a lot about where the bait is. And so I don't really worry about where the fish are, more as to where is the bait. Once I find the bait, I'm more likely to, you know, I'm more likely to find the fish.
So, talking more about food and flies here. Phil had asked also about what other forage fish besides the threadfin are you trying to imitate, and is the threadfin probably the most common one that you're imitating?
It is. The threadfin is certainly the most common one. The second most common one would be the gizzard shad. They're both in the herring family. The difference is a gizzard shad can be anywhere from 4 or 5 inches long up to 14 inches long. They're going to look more like a herring or a bunker type, menhaden type bait fish. The threadfin shad aren't going to get much bigger than probably 5 inches. And most of the time in my lake, they're going to be anywhere from 1 to 3 inches. But I have friends, you know, one of my very dear friends, Blaine Chocolate, fishes Smith Mountain Lake, and his shad generally tend to be 3 to 5 inches long, where on my lake on Lanier here in Georgia, my shad are generally 1 to 3 inches long. So, you know, the bait varies. We also have blueback herring, which were not indigenous to my lake, but the blueback herring is another bait fish that can go anywhere from the average 4 to 6 inches, but they can get upwards of 10, 12 inches, but most of them are in that 4 to 6 inch range. And so, once again, we have gizzard shad, we have threadfin shad, and we have blueback herring. Most lakes across the country and river systems across the country are definitely going to have gizzard shad and threadfin shad. So those are going to be the forage that's going to be the one that we're all going to kind of deal with. And then every certain lakes are going to have another. They're going to have a jack types fish, like in Kentucky. They may have some alewives or some jack type fish that we don't have in Georgia, or California might have a Japanese smelt or something like that. Who knows? There are other species out there that may not be common to all lakes, but the threadfin and the gizzard are going to be what the common denominator is for most of us.
Okay. Lots of people wrote in wanting to know about your favorite flies. So we'll start out with Tom Franco, Richmond, Virginia. He says, I saw you tie the cow and coyote at a fly show. It's a great pattern. What's your next best pattern, and how do you fish it?
Well, you know, it's such a hard question to ask. I could probably live with a half a dozen flies in my box almost for the whole year, and be good with striper fishing. I need a bait fish type pattern in the box. So, you know, I have a fly that we designed called Cowan's Bait Fish. It's a very Pugliese style like fly, except that it's a lot more translucent. It uses a lot less material on it. It's got weight added to the shank of the hook, so it gets down quicker, and it's got the magic fly tying material built into it, the hot pink fluorofiber, which I put on almost every fly I tie. So that's an important fly. A clouser minnow, you just got to have a clouser. I mean, it's silly to even think why you'd leave without a clouser. The coyote is a great searching pattern for us. It's got the spinner blade on it. It's a fly fisherman's roadrunner, for lack of a better term. A roadrunner, Blakemore roadrunner, is a lure that's been used for 50 years by conventional anglers, and I used it when I lived up in New York and Connecticut when I first started striper fishing back in the 70s, and so that was the coyote was actually the adaptation to the roadrunner. So that would be another good one. I can't tell you how much I like Lane Chocolate's Game Changer. That is one of my favorite flies to fish. It'll catch anything that swims. I will always have Game Changers in my box. I have a fly that I designed called a Something Else. It's nothing more than a polar fiber clouser minnow. But the nice thing is that when you tie a clouser about an inch and a half or 2 inches long, the fibers aren't long enough. The bucktail's not long enough, so it doesn't breathe. It comes through the water looking like a stick, where a 3-inch long clouser minnow has enough movement and breathability in the bucktail. So I designed a fly using polar fiber, and we called it a Something Else. And when that threadfin shad gets to about a half an inch to 2 inches long, there is absolutely nothing on the planet that will outfish a Something Else when they're on that itty-bitty juvenile bait fish. We've used it in salt and fresh, and it's just fantastic. And then finally, you know, for a topwater fly, you know, there's a lot of great topwater flies. I love Charlie Bisharat's Pole Dancer. I love a wiggle minnow. I love gurglers. So those, I love crease flies. Joe Blados's crease fly, or the Rondon crease fly, which is similar, just that it's a little more, it's probably got a little more beef to it that it's not going to break. But that crease fly is another one of my favorites. So those are just a bunch of different topwater patterns that I would carry. But, you know, I don't get to topwater fish as much as I'd like, just on our lake, because we have blueback herring. If we didn't have blueback herring in my lake, I would have a much better topwater bite. If your lake has just threadfin shad and gizzard shad, there's a good chance your topwater bite is going to be a longer season. Whereas if you have a blueback herring in your lake, like I have in my lake, those fish tend to stay deeper and scatter more. So my topwater bite is 2 or 3 weeks long on both sides of the season, in the spring and the fall, where people in other lakes like Smith Mountain could have a 4 or 5 week long topwater bite because it's all threadfin shad, which is great. So that's just an array of different flies that
yeah, that's
I like
good. That answers Tom, Joe, Steve's, Larry, and Jason's questions. So, while Henry was answering, I went out to Henry's site, and you guys just go out to Henry's site, henrycowanflyfishing.com, and go to Henry's Flies, and you'll see, I'm sure, these are some of his favorites listed here with the recipes and everything. So, and nice pictures of each. So there you go. He's got it all set for you there. Good. Let's see. There was some questions that came in on the internet. I wanted to check on that. Okay, so Rod in Texas, he says, I prefer fishing striped bass in rivers looking for the early topwater bite. What's your go-to topwater fly? So did you just go over that?
Yeah, you know, everybody. That's such a subjective question because everybody has their go-to topwater fly, and there are so many good ones out there. I will tell you this. I have never seen a striped bass hit a fly harder than a Bisharat pole dancer. It's the most vicious strike. I mean, it looks like they don't want to eat it. They absolutely want to crush it. And while it's not the most, it's not the easiest fly in the world to cast, you really need a 9 weight for it. I know Charlie, who's the designer of the fly, one of my dearest friends, Charlie Bisharat, will argue with me that he can cast it with a 7 or an 8, but Charlie was 6'4" and played running back for the University of Oregon, and I'm 5'9", and, you know, I need to eat my spinach before I go out fishing. So I need a 9 weight for that fly. But that probably is my favorite go-to topwater fly would be the pole dancer, which is a walk-the-dog type bait. It goes left, right, like a Zara spook, and I just can't tell you how much I enjoy fishing that fly.
And, folks, you can Google Charlie Bisharat. It's B-I-S-H-A-R-A-T. A bunch of posts out there on the pole dancer, so you can look that up, check that out. Another one on flies here that came in on the Internet, Chris Smith in Oklahoma. He says, and I guess maybe this is something you do, I don't know, Henry. He says, can you explain how weighting the rear portion of the streamer hook shank affects the action of the streamer?
Yeah, so I have a fly that I've been tying that is basically just a keel-weighted bait fish, and the keel-weighted bait fish came about from a tire out in California by the name of Dave Sellers. And Dave came up with a fly called the SST, Sellers SST, which is the SST is Sellers Striper Teaser. And what Dave tried to do is he tried to come up with a way to tie a fly that would imitate a fluke, a Zoom fluke, which is a soft plastic conventional style bait that we use when we're not fly fishing, and it just does these crazy things going left and right and up and down. It's magic. When you put one near a striper, and it's like putting candy in front of it. It's almost an impossible not to get a hook up with it. So Dave came out with this fly called a SST, and what he did was, when you think about most flies where we put, let's say we want to weight the fly, we might wrap lead around the shank of the hook to get it to sink evenly and get it down quickly. Some guys will put a big old bead in the front of the fly, which will get it to dive nose first. Some guys will put these dumbbell eyes either a third of the way back, possibly halfway back, to get it to sink either on a nose dive or a little more even keeled. What Dave did was actually something more ingenious. What he did was he weighted his fly on the rear. And by weighting the fly on the rear, he put all the weight in the back of the fly, tied his fly, and when you strip that fly in by giving short pop and stop types of action. In other words, let's say you use a 6 to 10 inch long strip where you strip it hard, stop, strip it hard and stop. That weight on the back of the fly makes the fly jackknife and it makes the fly dart left and right and up and down and goes all different directions. So what we call keel weighting a fly is just a great way to impart some different action on a fly. And I got to tell you guys, it doesn't just work for stripers, even though it's Sellers Striper Teaser. I can tell you that type of action will work on largemouth bass. It'll work on pike. It'll work on bluefish. It'll work on brown trout. It's just a great way to learn how to impart different action on the fly by what we call rear or keel weighting it. So that's something that I've been tying one of my baitfish flies on a 60-degree bend jig hook. And I just use the same kind of material. It's the SF, the Steve Farrar Flash Blend. And I'll just tie that with the keel weight on the back. I take one of these little shoot fire. I'm trying to think. Hairline Dubbin sells it. It's a scud weight. It's a large scud weight. And it looks sort of like a scud. And it's made out of tungsten. And you just wrap it on the back right near the bend in the hook and then tie the rest of your fly. And you can impart action on there that you just wouldn't believe.
Cool.
That's a great question.
Yeah, great tip too. Okay, let's talk. Let's kind of finish up here with some strategies and tactics and so forth for stripers. You talked a lot about using, you know, the natural birds and animals and so forth to find fish. Is there anything else you want to talk about finding fish on the lake?
Well, you know, you got to have a good depth finder. By the way, that's another piece of equipment you need on the boat. You got to have a fish finder on the boat. That's a must, because otherwise all you're doing is looking for fish on the surface. And there's a lot of different fish finders out there, and all of them work great, but there's nothing better, in my opinion, than the Humminbird fish finder. They are just making some of the best equipment out there right now that is reasonably priced. And who doesn't like a reasonably priced piece of equipment? Their electronics, to me, is the bomb. So I have a Humminbird fish finder on my boats, and I use that a lot to find the fish. When I use the wildlife for, I'll tell you what the best part of the wildlife is so when you see terns and gulls flying and diving on the water, we know they're picking up bait fish. So I will always go to look. If I see a flock of gulls or terns in an area, I'll run over there to look and see if the bait fish are there. If I see a loon, and, you know, loons can go under the water probably 20, 30 feet down, and they'll come back up, and you might see a loon pop down under the surface and come up, Roger, 200 feet away. And then he'll pop back down again, and he'll come up another 200 feet away. When I see that, that loon tells me he's looking for bait fish. Doesn't tell me he's found anything. It tells me he's searching. But when I see a loon go down and come up and go back down again and come up in a very confined area, that I will fish over that loon almost every time. There is bait on top of that loon. Otherwise, that loon would be moving. So I can use the posture of the birds to tell me what's going on. If I see a greater blue heron sitting on a point and his neck is extended as opposed to his neck being tucked into his body, that bird is hunting. If I'm riding down the lake at 40 miles an hour and all of a sudden I come by a point and there's a loon sitting on that, I mean a greater blue heron sitting on that point with his neck extended, I am shutting that motor down, putting my electrics on and hitting that point and searching with a sinking line immediately. So those are the things we can use. We have birds that are called kingfishers. They're sort of bluish looking. They kind of look like a woodpecker kind of bird. You'll find
them. They're
really cool
looking.
They're really cool birds. And kingfishers are bait eaters. So if I see kingfishers squawking in the back of a cove and diving, I'm going to stop and make some casts. I mean, there's a lot that you can learn. Don't worry about finding the fish so much as finding the bait fish. That's the most important thing, is find the bait and you will find the stripers. And let the wildlife tell you. I'll never forget many, many years ago, and this I'm just equating something totally different to this, but many, many years ago I was down in the Keys and we were fishing laid up tarpon. And we could pull up to a spot and we'd pull up and pole to a tarpon and the guide would say, "Nah, he's not going to eat." We pull up to another thing, "No, that one's not going to eat either." We pull up to the next one, he goes, "That's an eater." Now, I had no idea what he was looking at, but he looked at the posture of the fish and knew that fish was going to be, you know, a willing contestant versus not. And I can tell you from the posture of my wildlife that I see on the lakes and on the rivers, I can tell you where there's going to be bait, where there's going to be fish, or where there's going to be both. And it's just so keeping an eye out and dialing into your wildlife is probably one of the best things you can do as an angler to try and help cut that learning curve down to finding these fish.
Right. Great. Great. So what kind of mix do you do? When you're using the fish finder, are you then looking for schools of bait fish? Does it pick that up, or are you looking?
It will. So you'll look and see this dark mass on the fish finder, where the actual stripers will look like arches, upside-down arches. It'll be like upside-down Vs on the screen. And so if you go onto my website and go onto some of my photo gallery, you'll see some of the shots that I have where you'll see my screen is just lit up with hundreds of striped bass under the boat. And what's really interesting is the stripers are almost always, I don't know why this is, but they're usually almost always on top of the bait. They're not under the bait. You would think they'd be under the bait, but they're usually not. They're usually on top of the bait. And then all of a sudden, when they start to get into their feeding frenzy under the surface, you'll see the arches through the masses where they're in the bait. So, you know, yes, what I am, in answer to your question, I do look for big gobs of bait fish on the screen Because if I'm not seeing bait, if I pull into a cove and I'm not seeing bait, I'm probably not going to find the stripers. So
right.
I need to find the bait first. And if I can find the bait, and then I can find some diving terns or a couple of loons that are going crazy or whatnot, you know, then I'm eventually going to going to hit the jackpot. And that's really what I use my fish finder for.
Right. Okay, good. And then, and I wouldn't exactly call, you know, blind casting in a situation like that where you know there's fish down there. But do you ever do blind casting? Or
I do.
Okay.
All the time.
Okay.
I blind cast twice. There are two times of the year where I'm blind casting all the time. When I'm popper fishing on top, when I'm fishing for feeding fish that are going to eat off the surface, you know, during the top water time. So there are times of the year where even though you're not seeing the fish blowing up bait on top, they will still eat a popper off the top in that 70 to 75 degree water temperature. I will go from point to point to point. My lake has reef markers on it, and those reef markers tell you that there's an obstruction under the water there. And so if you looked at that reef marker, if you looked at the topography of it with your fish finder, take your boat right up to the reef marker, turn around and go out to the deeper water off that point. And you'll see that when you go up to the reef marker, you're in 3 feet of water, and then you go another 30 feet out and you're in 6 feet of water. You go another 40 feet out and you're in 12 feet of water. Go another 50 feet out and you're at 18 feet of water. It's a tapered point. I will pull up and blind cast on those tapered points in the spring all the time. I mean, it's a great way with a topwater fly to do that. And then consequentially, I'll take a sinking line with a coyote. A coyote is my favorite searching pattern when I'm trying to blind cast and look for fish. I'll throw a coyote on a sinking line on those points and make a half a dozen casts and then move on. And, you know, I know this is a fly fishing show, but I'm going to give you guys a great tip. If you want to catch a fish on top water, one of the greatest things in the world that you can do to shorten your learning curve to this, you know, I know what points on my lake generally hold fish to eat off the surface. I have my favorite topwater points all over the lake that I know where to fish. For the guys who are new to that and they're trying to learn, well, where's a good topwater point to start? Bring a spinning rod with you and take the hooks off the spinning rod, off the lure. Take yourself a popper, a chug bug, or a redfin, or, you know, any sort of Zara spook, and take the hooks off. And when you get up to that point, make 4 or 5 casts with the spinning rod. If you don't get any bites, move on to the next point. If all of a sudden a fish comes up and blows up on it, he's not going to feel the steel because there's no hook. So you've used that hookless popper as a bird dog to find the fish, and now you can come back with your fly rod and try and catch that fish. And
yeah,
I do that all the time when I'm blind casting looking for fish.
That's a great tip. When you know there's a school of fish out there, I know this is going to be different, but we basically got top water. We've got fish that are maybe in the top, 3 to 6 feet of water, and then we've got the deep fish. Do you mix up any kind of presentation skills to that, or are you pretty much doing the same thing with just different?
With the sinking lines, it's a countdown method. You know, we know those sinking lines sink 1 foot every 2 seconds. It's six inches per second sink rate, so it sinks 1 foot every 2 seconds. So if I happen to be finding fish in a cove that are 20 feet down, then I know when I cast to those fish behind the boat, I got to let that fly sink 40 seconds to get it down 20 feet. And then that fly is in the zone. The most important thing I can tell anglers who want a striper fish on these freshwater impoundments is the fish, when they're on threadfin shad, especially on threadfin shad, more than any other bait, they love to eat the wounded bait fish. They love, so how do you imitate that wounded bait fish? The best thing you can do is short, quick strips. I'm talking 2-3 inches long, Roger. Nothing more than 3 inches long. Strip, 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 stop. Pause for 3 seconds. Strip, 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 stop. Pause for another 3 seconds. Strip, strip, stop. Pause for another 3 seconds. I change the cadence up. 95% of your takes are going to be on the pause. When you go to strip again, you're going to feel the weight. That fly has already sucked down his throat. So it's really important to make short, quick strips with a pause. And the way I learned that was many years ago, I have a YouTube site, Roger, that's just Henry Cowan, one word straight across. And somewhere on there is a video that I took back in the early 2000s where I was making a video showing the posture of these gulls and terns flying on a bank, and I said, there are stripers under these birds. I can tell from the posture of the birds, and I'm filming. And as I pulled up and I stopped the boat, I put my trolling motor down, and I went up towards the birds, and I made a cast with my sinking line. And I cast out about 60 feet, and now I grabbed my video camera, and I'm panning across this area, talking about how these birds have found the bait, and there's got to be stripers in this area, just watching what these birds were doing, watching how low they were flying, going back into the same area over and over and over, and all of a sudden, I got an eat. While I was holding the rod in my right hand and panning around with the camera in my left hand, and then the chaos began, and I got the whole thing on camera. And it's somewhere on my YouTube site. I think it's called DIY Striper Fishing, something like that. But it was pretty comical. But I did get the fish in, but I learned a very valuable lesson that day.
Yeah, definitely. And all the filmmakers are very jealous at this point, you know. Sometimes you're out there for days trying to get that hookup.
Oh, God. You don't have to tell me. You know, when the camera boat comes, the fish usually go away. They go, yeah, they swim with their fins over their mouths.
Yeah, exactly.
I only know. I just had Conway Bowman out here about 3-4 weeks ago, and we did an episode of the Ford Outfitters. And he came, and the camera crew came. The day they came, they flew in on a Tuesday night, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We had a 5-day, the longest cold front in the last 30 years here in Georgia in the spring. It was the longest cold front that we've ever had, and that's when the camera crew showed up, right at the start of the cold front. It was just miserable. I mean, we got it done, but it was not easy.
Yeah. Well, let's finish up with your friend Tom T. here. I know you don't want to answer his question, but I'm going to make you. So he says, when you fish different parts of the pond, and he's talking about Lanier, I guess, here, when you generally fish north versus south, define north versus south, and how much water do you cover in a typical morning? Do you make
a few
casts and then depart, or do you generally work a location hard?
I have no patience. I am a stick and move kind of a guy. I mean, I can put on 70 miles in a day on one of my striper trips in the boat. That's how much moving I'm doing. If the fish are somewhere, I'll stick with it. But if I don't feel it, if I'm not seeing the wildlife, I'm not seeing the surface activity, I'm not seeing the bait on my fish finder, I'm not seeing a lot of other boats around me doing the similar thing, I am moving. I mean, I am just moving until I figure out, you know, and that's the hardest part about striper fishing in a lake versus a river versus salt water. You know, in a river, they're in a much more confined area, so they're really easy to find. I'm not saying striper fishing is easy in a river. I'm telling you it's 100 times easier than an impoundment. And salt water, you have tides to tell you where the fish are, but in fresh water, in warm water, in impoundments, we don't. So I have to really feel that there's going to be fish there for me to stick around and fish it. So I am moving constantly. So, you know, having a bigger boat with a bigger motor on a 600-mile shoreline, you know, square-mile shoreline impoundment allows me to run all over the places I need to. And so I move a lot. I really do. And the other thing is, you know, generally speaking, most, I can't say all lakes, but most lakes, especially in the southeast, that have river systems attached to them, in the north end of the lake will be, you know, the shallowest water versus the south end of the lake where there'll be a dam attached and it'll be a tailwater. So the deeper part of the lake is always on the south end, and that consequentially means in the late spring, summer, and early fall, that's where your fish are going to be. And in the north end, which is the shallower water, that's where your fish are going to be in the late fall, winter, and early spring, because the shallower water up there will heat up a little quicker. So the fish tend to run up that way, you know, and the bait tends to run up that way in the wintertime. And that's kind of just a generalization of what goes on these lakes.
Okay, great. Well, good. Well, time to wrap things up here, Henry. We've covered a lot of territory here, but time to call it a night. So I do want you to hang out with me a little bit more because we're going to give away a few prizes and ask some questions and so forth. But when we return, we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and also that $25 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder. So stick with us a few more minutes, and we'll get those prizes awarded, and we'll be done for the night. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave your comments, and be good to go. Now it's time to give away our prizes, and our winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And if you haven't registered yet, it's too late now for tonight's drawing, but be sure to register for our next show, as we're always giving away some great gifts. And let me see here. The first prize we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. They're a great organization to support, and we love to have them sponsoring our shows. And let me see if I can get a winner here. And Ted Hasselbring. Ted, I know your name sounds very familiar. Ted, congratulations. You won a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Now, if you already have a membership, let me know, and we can get you extended with them. Now, the second thing, so congratulations, Ted. The second thing we're going to give away is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at AmatoBooks.com. Amato Books has all kinds of fly fishing publications as well as periodicals as well as books. It's a great place to explore and learn about fly fishing. And our winner for that is Ted Brashears in Texas. So, Ted, congratulations on that subscription as well. Now, I'll email you both after the show, get some information from you, and then we can start those membership and subscription up. Okay, congrats, guys. And next is doing the Q&A for the $25 gift certificate, Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. Check them out if you're out here in Colorado. Like I said, you can redeem your gift certificate if you win in the shop or online, either way. Now, okay, so the question is, Henry mentioned three different things that he needs in his boat besides, of course, rods, reels, flies, and so forth. So those other three things, name two of them and submit those in, and whoever gets that right gets the $25 gift certificate. So, Henry, I'm checking here, and see if we have any people that were listening.
I can't believe Tom didn't win.
No, he didn't. Phil McCartney in Kentucky did, I believe. Check me out on this, Henry. He said electric trolling motor and fish finder to locate both fish and bait fish schools. Is that a good answer for us?
That would be a home run. That would be two out of the three.
That's what we were looking for. So, Phil, congrats again. Phil is a longtime listener, and I have your email address, Phil, so I don't need anything more from you. I will get that in the works and and we'll get you that $25 gift certificate. So congratulations, Phil, and Rod and Ted, everybody that played. We appreciate you guys listening, and enjoy your prizes. Okay. So that's it, Henry. I really appreciate you being on with us tonight. Always a pleasure to talk to somebody that's so knowledgeable in their field, and you certainly are, and thanks for spending the time with us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Well, Roger, I appreciate you having us, and, you know, the only reason I'm knowledgeable in this is because I'm fortunate to have the Georgia Department of Natural Resources stocking our river, our systems here. Without those guys, we wouldn't have stripers, and I'd, you know, I'd be a dry fly fisherman, fishing for fish with spots instead of fish with stripes. You know?
There you go. Well, hopefully, everybody, you found our archive on our website. If you haven't, there's a couple of links to it on our homepage and at the bottom of every page. Go to the archive. We've got, 220-plus shows in the archive now. Everything from stripers to tarpon to brown trout to whatever you want in all places all over the country and the world. So check it out. It's a great resource to learn about fly fishing. Our next broadcast will be on June 15th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, I'm going to interview Shelley Walchak. And our topic for the show will be 52 rivers. Now get this, Shelley decided to challenge herself and set a goal to fish 52 rivers in 1 year. She quit her job and fished 7 states in the Rocky Mountains, which turned into one of, you know, those journeys she'll never forget. So join us to hear how she conceived, planned, and completed this epic fly fishing adventure. Wouldn't you guys all like to do that for a year? That'd be great, wouldn't it? So anyway, join us for that, and it should be a fun show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Watermaster, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.